Welcome to the Essential Southern Podcast, where we explore the rich history, culture, and traditions of the American South.
Welcome back to the Essential Southern Podcast. I'm your host, Brian McClanahan, and this podcast is sponsored by the Abbeville Institute. The Abbeville Institute is a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to exploring what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition. If you want to support our mission, if you want to support things like this, the podcast, our website, our conferences, all of our programs, go to abbevilleinstitute.org. That's A-B-B-E-V-I-L-L-E, institute.org. And you can make a tax-deductible contribution to the Institute. We do appreciate your generous support. All right. Well, let's talk about the topic of this Essential Southern Podcast, and it's E. Merton Coulter. Now, Coulter was one of the most important 20th century Southern historians. He wrote a number of books. He was a teacher in Georgia, at University of Georgia for years, a professor there. And his two most important works were published by Louisiana State University Press. One is The Confederate States of America, which is a huge volume on the history of the Confederate States. And the other was The South During Reconstruction. Now, he also wrote a really interesting history of Georgia, among many other things. He was a prolific writer, eventually by the end of his career, pretty much ostracized and sitting in his office every day without any contact with the other faculty because they just didn't like him. And they didn't like him because, well, he didn't say things that they wanted to hear. Coulter was a lost causer, someone who was writing history they thought to be invalid. In 1935, Coulter went before the Southern Historical Association, the Southern Historical Association in Birmingham, and he gave an address about the South and its history. What the South has done about its history? That's the title of the paper. And I'm going to read portions of this paper. It's a long essay. I don't have time in a 30-minute podcast to get through it all. But it's really important in how he looks at the South and what it's done about its own history. And again, Coulter, as a historian, was interested in this topic, not just as a pedantic exercise in what historians could do, but also as an exercise in the subject of history itself and the history of history. Why did the South start writing so much history after the war? He answers this question in the essay. And why didn't they write much of it before the war? That's also answered in this question, in this essay. So you have historical societies popping up in New England before the war. You have New Englanders much more interested in this subject. And of course, this is why when you go out and you look at the histories of early America, a lot of them are New England-driven or New England-centric because the documents that they have are much more focused on New England. I'll give you an example of that. I was looking at a book the other day about patriotic songs in America up till, I think the date was 1865. All of them, with the exception of about maybe a dozen, before 1861, focus on New England. New England poetry, New England song. There was a lot of stuff out there that wasn't in those New England newspapers. There are Southern newspapers that existed, and Southerners wrote these kind of things too. But this book and the editors and authors of this book didn't think that the South was really that important in bringing in these things. They focused on New England. I don't know if it's intentionally done, but it's lazy. I will say that. The other thing about Coulter that people didn't like, of course, is the way that he portrayed Reconstruction. He was very critical of Reconstruction. He's very critical of it in this essay. But his South During Reconstruction is a really interesting book. In fact, it's more interesting than what anybody else was really doing at the time, and that Coulter was a complete historian. What do I mean by that? He focused on things that weren't just political or diplomatic or military in nature. He focused on the South during Reconstruction, what was happening among the people, and things like sport and leisure ways. I mean, things you wouldn't even think of. It was a cultural history as well. It's a really interesting book. And people that are true professionals can look at these kind of things and say, yeah, I mean, we may not like some of culture's language, but we should value his contribution to the profession. And What you have, though, are a bunch of activists who don't want to do that because that would give credence to someone like Merton Coulter, and they just won't do it. They have to protect themselves and their own little ideological world. You can also look at the South and the Building of the Nation series in this same way. I mean, there are really good essays in that book. You can look at U.B. Phillips in this way. Phillips is denounced. But what Eugene Genovese did, of course, was take seriously Phillips' histories, and he wrote his histories based on those, and he improved on them. They're better, but he took seriously Phillips, where a lot of people won't. They just, Phillips says bad things. We just don't like this, so we're not gonna wrestle with Phillips. It shows you the immaturity of most modern historians. So let me get into this essay and talk about it for a little bit. Again, the title of this is What the South Has Done About Its History, 1935, E. Merton Coulter. The South has often been referred to as a virgin field for the historian. Other sections of the country have written almost the minutest details of their history or suffered others to do it, even to magnifying the Boston Tea Party and Paul Revere's raid into an importance which has permeated the national consciousness. While the South has permitted its history to lie unworked, and many of its major figures and movements to remain to this day unhonored and unsung. True statement, 1935. I don't know if you could say this as much now, but the line where he says we've allowed others to, or suffered others to do it is accurate, because when writing this in 1935, you had a whole bunch of future doctoral candidates say, yeah, what we need to do is have Southern studies programs, and let's go set up shop in the South, and we'll tell Southerners what their history means. He's saying that New Englanders have been doing this for a while, and they've elevated minute things, Boston Tea Party, Paul Revere's raid, into importance which has permeated. So were these things really that important? I mean, we talk about them, but we know there were other situations in other states that mirrored these things. But why is it that we only talk about Boston? Well, because Boston was writing histories. There are certain factors which enter into the growth of a new nation and a civilization, which operate rather uniformly and which must apply, therefore, somewhat equally to the South, the East, the North, and the West, or to whatever sections we may choose to include in our sum total. It is a truism that a country without a history cannot write it. And of course, the younger a country is, the less there is to write about or to be interested in. The writing of a nation's history is reminiscing for that nation, and it is a well-known fact that only old and oldish people do much reminiscing. As the Bowes Review said in 1853, it is not in the buoyancy of youth that men or nations look back on the past. That's a funny statement, right? So, I mean, people aren't, you know, young, they're not interested in it. We know it's only old or oldish people who do much reminiscing. Writing about a history is reminiscing. What is it? Young people aren't interested in reminiscing a whole lot. They're not sentimental. Whereas as you get older, you become sentimental. Yet the North and New England especially early began to look back on their short past, and they soon discovered that it was heroic and that there were giants in those days. They set to work writing about them, realizing that in union there is strength. Individuals early joining forces, organized historical societies, which first being statewide multiplied until scarcely a town in New England did not boast of such an organization. Histories accumulated until there was scarcely anything left to be written about. It is not necessarily here to inquire into the reasons for these activities, hasty though entirely laudable. It is sufficient to say that the compact settlements made it possible, that the character of the people led them early to begin looking backward as well as forward, and that their occupations developed a store of community spirit and a wealth of money. It's a really interesting slap at New England right there. It's subtle. But he's saying, look, this is, I mean, they're entirely laudable, but they're hasty. But why? Why? Well, they had small little communities, compact communities. The character of the people forced them to look backward as well as forward. In other words, they're ideological. And their occupations developed a store of community spirit and a wealth of money. They were money grubbing. In comparison with New England in the North, the South early fell behind in its historical consciousness. Not because it was less old or had a less interesting or important past, but for reasons that will soon appear, some of which, apart from the comparison, operated everywhere to retard historical activity. Though racially the North and the South cannot be so simply described as Puritan and Cavalier, there were nevertheless important differences in the people who settled the two sections. A great many Southerners were Scotch-Irish or of Scotch-Irish descent, and it may not be held to the discredit of other strains to say that the Scotch-Irish exercised an influence in the South out of proportion to their numbers. These people and many other Southerners were individualistic and greatly lacking in self-consciousness. They had little of that introspection which characterized the New Englander and made him busy himself not only with his own affairs, but also with the affairs of others. The Southerner was not community-minded, for he did not, as a rule, live in communities. And notice what just happened here. I mean, again, a slap at Yankees. Southerners really didn't have this cultural trait of the South was not focused on historical studies. This is David Hackett Fisher, Albion Seed, in the 1980s. He's writing that 50 years after Coulter said this. Southerners were acutely aware of cultural differences in 1935. Acutely aware. And what about Northerners? They had little of that introspection which characterized the New Englander and made him busy himself not only with his own affairs, but also with the affairs of others. It's a great line. The Southerner was not community-minded. He didn't really live in communities. They lived on farms and plantations. It was spread out. They didn't have these little compact towns that New England had. This fact suggests that the South developed a rural population and a civilization based almost entirely on agriculture. The people busied themselves in clearing the land and tilling the soil, largely isolated one from another. They thought in terms of their own problems and had little inclination to get interested in or to examine what had gone before. There long remained in the South many elements of the frontier, and no frontier can become much interested in its history, however long or short it may be. Only with that conservatism that comes with the long occupation of a region and a long association of people and communities does the historical spirit assert itself. Interesting statement about the study of history. Also, a certain amount of leisure is requisite, and an attitude of mind, untroubled and serene, helps. The South had little of either, despite a great deal of romancing to the contrary. Not until 1840 was the South rid of its Indian problems. The slavery issue was not settled until 1865, and then there followed the race question, which is as yet a matter of some concern. Much of the riding proclivities of Southerners in antebellum times was absorbed in a defense of slavery against Northern attacks. Without this disturbance, it is conceivable that Calhoun might have written learnedly on the philosophy of history, and Sims might have become a Southern Bancroft. So the political attacks, what was happening outside of what was going on, of course, the slavery question, made these people think about other things. Now, he does say there were other things going on here, and he, in this essay, which I'm not going to get into, he lists a large number of historians who did have kind of an interest in this stuff, but the best men didn't really do it. Now, Calhoun, of course, didn't write about the philosophy of history, but he wrote the only unique work of political philosophy in American history, in the Disquisition and Discourse. That was it. Nobody else has done it besides Calhoun. The restlessness that was bred by these conditions made the people prefer action to contemplation. Their genius sought expression, therefore more in the excitement of politics. The embryo historians and history readers became politicians and statesmen. That's perhaps true. I mean, Southerners were better at politics than Northerners. There's a book, The Natural Superiority of Southern Politicians, is written in the 1970s, really gets into this. And of course, even in the South of the Building of the Nation series, you have a section of that dedicated to the orators, right? The people that were good at this. New Englanders really couldn't match it. There were a few, but for the most part, they couldn't. I mean, I think someone like Fisher Ames, who was good at it. But for the most part, they had no one that could match the South when it came to oratory. I mean, Daniel Webster is often, elevated to a position of a great orator. He was okay. Not unique in what he said. I mean, unoriginal is really true, but I mean, he was okay. As a Southerner diagnosed the situation in 1853, quote, when the offices of the federal and state governments were filled, few men of distinguished abilities were left unemployed. Days of action and fame loomed up ahead. Who would sit down in his quiet study and endeavor with toil and pain to exact truth out of a mass of contradictory authorities when the same energies directed at another channel might make him the ruler of a continent, the arbiter of the world? The apathy of Virginians toward their history was partly explained by a writer in 1847 who said, quote, we have seen it summarily accounted for by the fact that the gentlemen and higher classes of Virginia are so much occupied with the duties of self-government and of governing others that they have no time to spend over the records of past ages, that they, who are acting history themselves, care not to read the histories of other men. Interesting. I mean, these people are doing history. They're active in it. They don't really care about what happened with other men. But those who did attempt to write the South's history were immediately confronted with a situation which could be counted on to weather the keenest zeal. The records of the past were scattered and many of them had been destroyed. The people not much interested in their past will take few pains to preserve their current records and even fewer to save old documents. Why should those with little self-consciousness who want no heroes to worship and who think objectively care to save the musty records of the past out of which unwanted heroes could be made? Not looking for heroes in the past, they were not even interested in making heroes out of themselves. Therefore, there was no passion to preserve family archives. And let me stop here and say this. There was one person who did this. That was William Gilmore Sims. He preserved a lot of stuff. You know what happened to it? Well, the Union Army burned it when they burned his house down. All of that stuff, gone. He had a lot of material burned by the war. Washington. A lot of his stuff was collected by the Lees. I mean, it was there. And that stuff was stolen off. I mean, when you burn stuff out, and he's going to get into that, when you burn these things down after the war, there were people that had these things. And they started becoming more historically conscious in the 1830s. And he mentions that in the essay. The 1830s was a time when people started thinking about this. But when you have these kind of problems, and he gets into that a little bit later, you get this kind of situation. The progression of plantations westward led families to discard their old papers as the least desirable impedimenta. And what was even worse, this unconcern for the past led to a woeful carelessness in public officials in preserving the records of the government. After the current value of documents had passed, they were discarded to an attic or basement, there to rest undisturbed until accumulating in such quantities they became a nuisance. This problem was then solved either piecemeal by some janitor using them as a store of fuel for kindling fires or all at once, like Tennessee, which cut the Gordian knot as late as the 20th century by selling them as waste paper. Just get rid of this stuff. It doesn't matter. Aiding this carelessness of private individuals and of government officials were forces which could not easily be controlled. Wars, fires, and migrating state capitals wrought sad havoc with the South's records. The South has suffered two wars of invasion, which scattered and destroyed state archives. In the Revolution, Georgia was able to carry part of her records to a place of safety, but so far away that she was unable to recover them for some years afterwards. And in the Civil War, she saw many of her records pillaged and carried away by Sherman's soldiery, and even to this day, their conscience-stricken descendants are returning the plunder. But it has been from fires more than from wars that the South has suffered. The flames that destroyed the capitals of Texas and Louisiana deprived succeeding generations of many priceless records and consigned to darkness much that was important. Pathetic is the story of county and parish archives, the records that come nearest to the lives of the people. Chronically suffering from the carelessness of local officials, they have gone up in smoke from one end of the South to the other. North Carolina has no fewer than 33 courthouse fires. For many years, the moving population of the South carried state capitals not far behind. The instability of all material things long characterized the South. There is not a state in the South today which has not changed the site of its first capital. Georgia has had no fewer than 5 separate state capitals, migrating from Savannah on the coast to Atlanta on the edge of the mountains. It is not difficult to imagine what happened to the state archives when capitals were moved. I mean, look at all this destruction, destitution, all of this stuff. This is horrible, right? I mean, this is a problem that the North did not have. I mean, how often did the northern states move their capitals? Not as often. They moved them, but not as often. and they had the security that the South did not have. They weren't frontier states. New England's locked in. New York is generally locked in. Pennsylvania is locked in. And, of course, you throw in the fact that New York City and Philadelphia became the seat of government, and you're going to have the central government, you're going to have more interest in it there. So this is a problem the South had that the North did not. He said, this recounting of the South historical apathy and woes happily is not the whole story. With all these handicaps, there has been an appreciation and progress and flashes of an historical outlook equal to the best. The South has written histories, collected documents, organized historical societies, and published historical articles and magazines. The South of colonial days had few incentives to be interested in its history. It had no nationalism or even a spirit of nationalism, and it had only a short past, which had no special appeal. Yet Virginia could have a feeling of some age and a desire to look back upon it, for she had lived longer as a colony of England than she has as a part of the American Union. And this historical spirit was felt by Robert Beverly in 1722 and William Stith in 1747, when each brought out his history of Virginia. No other southern colony had a history sufficiently heroic to lead its being written. So Virginia could have done this. And he goes through a large number of works here and an interesting discussion of what happens beginning with that period of time into the 1830s. And I'm going to skip over this and get to what happened later. Okay. And when we talk about what came later, what I mean by that, of course, is the writing of the Lost Cause. So oftentimes, modern historians will focus on that period of time and basically say these people lied. What Coulter is doing here is explaining why people became so interested in the South in this period of time afterwards in writing their history. Why did they do it? What happened? Why are all these Southerners who had not much interest in writing history until the 1830s, and they started collecting things and doing things, but which were still paling in comparison to the North, why did they become so intently interested in history in 1865? He says, but with all the thoughts and actions of the antebellum South, practical historical activities and developments never got far beyond state lines. We're writing state histories in the South, not a comprehensive history of the South. People are writing about Georgia or South Carolina or North Carolina, Virginia. Everything is focused on the state. The slavery system and the attacks of the North upon it welded the Southern states into a spiritual unity on that subject, but they still thought of their history larger within state lines. So as Northerners attacked the South, they all kind of galvanized around that one issue, but everything else was still disjointed. There was no real Southern examination of the region as a whole. It was still focused on Virginia, Alabama, Georgia, you know, whatever it is. They wrote much to defend Southern institutions and Southern civilization, but no one thought of writing a Southern history or of organizing a Southern historical society. In 1861, Civil War came, and then the people forgot all about the writing of history. Instead, they began making history. They lost the war and their nationality, but they went through an experience which touched profounder depths and involved more fundamental principles than had come into their lives since the planting of Jamestown. Here in the course of 4 years, enough history had been made to keep many generations busy investigating and writing it. And here was something for those who liked heroic history, and much for those who liked to philosophize on cause and consequence. But there was even more, for here was the great task to see that the truth be told and the record kept straight. Out of the crucible of war, there was born a sense of unity in their history. And so now their history could become regional instead of state, just as their feelings in antebellum times had become sectional instead of state. So, the defeat and the war, notice what he says, it makes them interested in keeping the record straight. The truth be told in keeping the record straight. The most immediate effect the war had on the historical consciousness of the South was the writing of the lives and war experiences of the heroes by the heroes themselves and by others, and the recounting of the campaigns by the leaders. Writers produced lives of Stonewall Jackson even before the end of the war, but no one could have planned much earlier the history of the conflict than James B. McCabe, Jr., who said in May 1861, I commenced to collect such papers and documents, both official and unofficial, relating to the war as I could procure. By the end of the struggle, he had on hand more than 15,000 papers and documents, and in 1866, he brought out the Life and Campaigns of General Robert E. Lee. Immediately after the war, General Lee considered writing a history of his campaigns solely as a last tribute to his men, and he asked other leaders to write their campaigns. For a time, Lee set about systematically collecting reports and documents, but he found it very difficult to secure some necessary material. It is said that he was refused by the War Department the use of documents which it had, but no positive proofs have been found so far that Lee ever applied. Lee gradually gave up his intention of writing history, but many of the other Confederate leaders, following his advice, wrote their accounts, some for glory, some for money, some to defend their reputations, and some only for the love of it. Most of the writings by the war generation were deeply tinged with the defense element, and especially was this so with those who wrote civil and political history. Alexander H. Stephens wrote two volumes in his Constitutional View of the War Between the States to show the justice of the South's course, and Jefferson Davis wrote his two volumes on the rise and fall of the Confederate government, largely for the same purpose. The North, having won the war on the battlefield, immediately set out to win it again and consolidate victory on the printed pages. This is true. I mean, they did this. So we have this back and forth of the historiography of this period of time, where accusations are made that Southerners were biased in their histories, and somehow that would mean the North was unbiased. It's just untrue. The North was just as biased. They were defending their position. They were showing their righteousness of their cause, because you had to come up with some reason to justify the slaughter of a million Americans, the destruction of an entire section of the United States, the economy of which, you know, didn't recover for decades. You have to justify it. You have to, because a war simply for union doesn't have the same moral force as a war to end slavery. So, the righteous cause myth is born. And in the South, you have Southerners, some Southerners minimizing slavery and other things, but that wasn't as pronounced as people think. In fact, if you go back and read much of the material collected, they're open about slavery, and they say things about it. Some people will say things, slavery, you know, they never say it wasn't that important. What they all say is that wasn't important as a part of the larger picture, which was federal power. They all say that. In fact, if you read Pollard's The Lost Cause, he puts slavery front and center. I mean, people don't realize that, but he does. These people weren't embarrassed about it. They would say things like, we're happy it's over, and you know, it was stained upon the South. There would be these kind of statements, but they weren't embarrassed about it. That would come later. A new invasion was on, and the South must meet words with words, but words based on historical facts. Said Edward Pollard in 1866, quote, all persons in the South who assist in getting the true testimony of their unfortunate struggle perform a last but most important office of faithful love and do a noble work in rescuing the name of a lost cause from the slanders of those who, having been our accusers and executioners in this present time, would also be our judges at the bar of history. So that statement of Pollard, well, here it is. These people are going to be disingenuous. But you look at real professional historians in this period of time, they said, we want the South to tell its own story. What do these people really think? And why would they lie? They weren't. That's the thing. So Pollard is saying in 1866, we have to tell our story because we're going to be, by the righteous cause mythologists, by those who would be our accusers and executioners, they're also our judges at the bar of history. And they understood the importance of that. They had to produce their own histories, because if they didn't, it would be written for them, and those histories would be inaccurate in their mind. And they're right about that. In many cases. Not in all, but in many cases. And 10 years later, R. Randolph Stevenson was saying the Southern actors in the great struggle would be recreant to the duty which they owe to their posterity, were they to permit the false allegations of the Northern historians to be accepted as true without attempting a refutation and vindication. So why would they just let people come in and write their history? I mean, does any other people let somebody do this? And in any other people, would it be acceptable? For example, nowadays we have all of these, you know, deconstructed fields of history. And it's often said that in those deconstructed fields, people who are not part of those groups cannot write those histories. For example, if we're talking about women's history, men who get into women's history, even though there are some, but there are very few, are seen as outliers because only women can write the history of women. Almost all of your historians who are involved in black history are black because it's seen as improper for white historians to write these histories. But why is it that in the South, when you have Southern history, it's okay for anybody who's not Southern to write this stuff? You see what's going on there. New Englanders want New Englanders to write their own history. They've done it for years. Anyone who comes out and is critical of New England history, you're just saying this. You're just somebody who's not from New England. You don't understand. We want the people in those communities to write those histories, perhaps because they're sentimental, perhaps because they're sympathetic, and that's okay. You want those things. I have no problem with people in those groups writing those histories. That's great. Why is it the South can't do it for themselves? Because there has to be a boogeyman in American society. That's it. That's the question. And it's the question, it's the problem, really, of Southern history in many ways. History now took on for Southerners a more practical character than had ever appeared before in all the annals of the South. It was the last stronghold of the South, not for the defense of its nationality, but for the protection of something more dear and sacred, its reputation. Defeated on the battlefields, it was again suffering in Reconstruction, the defeat of its reasonable expectations of an honorable peace. With Jefferson Davis destined never to be tried and the Reconstruction Acts withheld from the judges, it was denied the right of that vindication of the courts which it had reason to expect. For years, unrepresented in the halls of Congress and then misrepresented there by scalawags and carpetbaggers, the South had only one tribunal left, the Bar of History. Now, this is the language that people don't like. Benjamin H. Hill said, quote, "Thus denied by our enemies the opportunity of silencing by the solemn judgment of their own courts the fierce accusations of criminality and secession, and denied by our enemies and the follies of our own people the glorious chance of vindicating our cause in high debate, and face to face with the chosen champions of our accusers, we have but one recourse left for us for our defense or vindication. That resource is history, impartial and unpassioned, unoffice-seeking history. And further, we owe it, therefore, to our dead, to our living, and to our children to be active in the work of preserving the truth and repelling the falsehood so that we may secure for them and for us just judgment from the only tribunal before which we can be fully and fairly heard." And Benjamin M. Palmer said, "Sir, there is a tribunal before which even nations must appear, a tribunal before which old causes shall be retired and the final verdict be rendered, which can never again be reversed." That's why the South began to write its history. And it's why the South took the pen, because they thought this is the only way they could preserve the truth. In many ways, what we do at the Abbeville Institute is an outgrowth of that. Because we've had years of people talking about the South who want to, for various reasons, have an agenda. And that agenda was clear. Southerners knew it. E. Merton Coulter knew it in 1935. He talks about Southern historical societies from this point forward and all the things they did and all the publications and all the stuff. He does say by the 1930s we'd gotten to professional historians, and he hoped he was imploring them to write good histories. But we do see that the profession has taken a different turn many times, and that it's not always fair in its judgment or balanced in its survey of things that happened, or it's too focused on one issue or another. But anyways, this is a really interesting essay. You can get it at JSTOR, J-S-T-O-R. You can get an account there. You get so many articles free of charge. I think it's like 100 articles you can read free of charge. And again, the title is What the South Has Done About Its History, E. Merton Coulter. You can look that up. Get a free account. Get this. You can't download it, but you can read it online. And you can enjoy the rest of the piece. But we've gotten up against the barrier here in time. So I'll see you next time for the next podcast. Till then, have a good day.